This is the Historians Podcast, and I'm Bob Cudmore. On this episode, we're going to string together several columns that I've written for Focus on History, the history piece that appears in the Amsterdam Recorder and the Daily Gazette. The first one talks about soda bottlers. 19th century soda bottlers drank more than soda. In an 1886 article on the carbonated soda industry, an Amsterdam newspaper painted a bleak picture. The heavy glass bottles sometimes exploded when being filled, injuring workers. The workload was heavy in the summer months. The Daily Democrat newspaper stated, and we quote, "A soda water manufacturer said that it was unquestionably true that the majority of hands taken on for the summer trade were men in the habit of getting drunk, but it wasn't in a degree excusable by the extremely hard labor," said the management person, "required of these workers during the busy season." Just over three decades later, soda bottlers in Montgomery and Fulton counties were raising prices on carbonated beverages a month after America entered World War I. The Bottlers Association of Fulton and Montgomery Counties bought a newspaper ad to explain the price hike to customers. The 1917 ad stated that raw material costs were going up, sugar up 100%, extracts up 50%. The price of soda cases had risen 30%, and labor costs had increased 15%. A case of 12 pints of soda now cost customers 75 cents, and a case of 12 quarts cost $1.25. Plus, the bottlers required a deposit of 2 cents for each small bottle and a nickel for each large bottle. Members of the trade group in 1917 were several companies in Amsterdam. Fitzgerald was one, Case another, Welch and Redding, all in Amsterdam. Jones Bottling Works in Fonda, and Gross Bottling in Gloversville. Fitzgerald's Bottling Works, founded in 1882, lasted almost a century. The bottling plant relocated in 1915 to 465 East Main Street in the town of Amsterdam on what is now Chapman Drive. Fitzgerald relocated to Freeman's Bridge Road in Glenville in the late 1960s. Company president Gerald Fitzgerald lived with his wife across the street from the Amsterdam plant, was known as Fitz, and died in 1970. Let's change the topic and talk about Lurie's. M. Lurie and Company of Amsterdam, the city's premier department store in downtown's heyday, opened in 1908. History buff Emil Suda said Lurie's had an impressive look about it, covered in a shiny black facade with the name M. Lurie and Company in large white block letters. "What made an impressive appearance," said Emil, "at Lurie's was the island walk. It was a walk around in the center of the main entrance that was lighted at night and showcased fashionable apparel." Lurie's was known for its pneumatic tube cash system, where the money was sent to a central location in the store and then sent back by these pneumatic tubes. Mildred Allen from Eagle Street worked at the change room in Lurie's, which was elevated, the change room was, a few steps off the floor, creating a balcony look. Another interesting point about Lurie's, the store had its own discount stamp books. Isidor Dembski felt stifled working at Lurie's in the men's department in the 1930s before leaving town and seeking his fortune at college and in Hollywood as the actor Kirk Douglas. Historian Dan Weaver wrote in a 2019 Recorder article, "Born in 1857, Morris Lurie emigrated from Lithuania to Troy, New York, when he was 15. Lurie opened his first store on Fulton Street in Troy. Weaver wrote, "Over time, he opened other stores in Little Falls, Schenectady, and Amsterdam, all in New York State, and in North Adams, Massachusetts." According to Weaver's article, Morris Lurie died in 1932. His son Abraham then ran the Amsterdam store until he died in 1945. In 1931, Abraham and his wife Fanny Lurie were living in Amsterdam at 196 Guy Park Avenue. After 1945, Louis Lurie, another son, was company president, and Howard Hallenbeck managed the Amsterdam store. Jonas Sokolowski and Bernard Mass of New Jersey bought Lurie's in 1972. The next year, the state closed Lurie's for failure to pay taxes. Weaver said the store was demolished to make room for the Amsterdam Mall. Our next story on our little podcast, with several of my history columns, which appear in the Daily Gazette and the Amsterdam Recorder, is called Weston the Pedestrian. When Edward Payson Weston strode into Amsterdam in 1910, the New York Times reported that Weston received the merriest reception which has been accorded him at any place during his walk across the continent. Weston, born in Providence, Rhode Island in 1839, started America's fascination with long-distance walking in 1861, when he trekked from Boston to Washington to fulfill a bet that he would accomplish the feat in 10 days if Abraham Lincoln won the presidential election. Weston's walk took 10 hours longer than 10 days, but he became famous nonetheless for his valiant effort, giving people a diversion in a very dark time. After the Civil War ended, Weston walked from Portland, Maine, to Chicago, Illinois, in 1867, to win a prize of $10,000. Gamblers took to betting on competitive walkers. Weston the Pedestrian, as he famously called himself, was in Amsterdam in October 1894 as part of a walk around New York State. He passed through Amsterdam again on his walk from Portland, Maine to Chicago in 1907 at age 68. When he started out, Weston was doing 50 miles a day. Weston went through Amsterdam on March 19th, 1909, on his 4,000-mile walk from the Atlantic to the Pacific Ocean, a journey that took 104 days. On his way back, he went through Amsterdam on the night of October 26th, 1910, receiving the tumultuous welcome that was reported by the New York Times. The Amsterdam Recorder had sent a reporter west to Tribes Hill to walk with Weston on the approach to Amsterdam. Hundreds were cheering the pedestrian along the road through Tribes Hill and the village of Aiken, later renamed Fort Johnson. Weston frequently doffed his hat to acknowledge women well-wishers and spectators waving American flags. The Recorder wrote, "The younger ones cared not where they dodged, and occasionally one of them would get directly in the pathway of the walker or else bump against him in the rear. When the crowds got too close, Weston would shout, 'Please, keep 10 feet away.'" The Amsterdam police chief escorted Weston from the city line on Guy Park Avenue, where the first fireworks were heard. Weston and his entourage turned down Caroline Street, then headed east on Division Street. When Weston turned right on Market Street, a flying wedge of high school boys made it possible for him to continue moving forward through the huge crowd. It was then that enthusiasm let loose, the recorder wrote, and the sirens of the automobiles, coupled with the red fire sticks and Roman candles, made a din that Market Street has never before seen. Fireworks ignited the awning on John Larrabee's hardware store, but the blaze was quickly extinguished with the aid of water thrown from the upper windows. Weston went inside the Barnes Hotel on Market Street and was whisked to his room, where he met with Stephen Sanford, Amsterdam's most prominent carpet mill owner. After Sanford left, wonder what they talked about, Weston rested. He came down about 2 a.m, saying he was feeling bully. He had breakfast, then resumed his marathon trek, heading for Schenectady, Troy, ultimately New York City. There he expected to give up walking for a while and go on the lecture platform, with his topic being the vicissitudes of a pedestrian. The last reference to Weston being in Amsterdam came in 1922, when the then 82-year-old Walker came through town September 23rd on his way to New York City. Weston, the pedestrian, was hit by a New York City taxicab in 1927. Badly injured, he stopped walking. He died in 1929 and was buried in New York City. The story of Weston, the pedestrian. We hope you enjoy the Historians Podcast. And if you do, we hope you'll be able to donate something, a little bit, a bit, to our Historians Podcast 2023 Fund Drive. You'll find a link to our GoFundMe campaign on our website, bobcudmore.com. It's outlined in blue, very prominent on the website. Or, if you'd rather donate by mail, you can make out a check to me, Bob Cudmore, and send the check to Bob Cudmore, 125 Horstman Drive, Scotia, New York, 12302. And thank you very much. We continue on the Historians Podcast with columns that I've written for Focus on History in the Daily Gazette and Amsterdam Recorder. This particular column had kind of a spin-off point from the news of the day with the loss of, I think it was 5 lives in this submersible that was trying to reach the Titanic to see that tremendous shipwreck on the bottom of the ocean floor. And the submersible, or little submarine, I guess you'd say, broke apart and killed all 5 people on board. The story I have in the, that I wrote a Focus on History column about, had to do with another incident involving a submarine which sank. There was greater loss of life, but they were able to save some of the crew members. And here's the story. Donato Danny Persico entered the submarine's escape hatch, crawling up a steel ladder. He crawled up the ladder because his hands were too chilled to grasp the ladder's rungs. And can you imagine what was going through his mind when he encountered that particular problem after what he'd been through? Like, you can't even climb a ladder. But he was able to get up the ladder by crawling and got into the escape hatch of the submarine. Persico lived on Broad Street on Amsterdam's south side. He was one of the survivors from the submarine USS Squalus, which sank May 23, 1939, in the Atlantic Ocean off the Isles of Shoals, New Hampshire. Valves malfunctioned during a test drive on the new submarine, the after compartments filled with water, drowning 26 men. Squalus settled on the ocean floor in 243 feet of water. As it went down, Persico, who worked in the torpedo room, was almost crushed by a torpedo. This happened so fast, there was no chance for an alarm, Persico told the Daily Gazette. We lost power and lost lights. In the forward compartments, sealed by watertight doors, 33 men, including Persico, were still alive. I had goosebumps, he said. I was scared. And at 20, he was the youngest man on board. Survivors donned woolen coats and stayed still as they could, using as little air as possible. Persico was among the last to be rescued on the fourth trip of a diving bell deployed from the rescue ship USS Falcon. Rescuers used the McCann Submarine Rescue Chamber, a diving bell that could withstand depths beyond lethal limits. The first three trips went perfectly. Captain Oliver Naquin, Persico, and six other sailors were in the diving bell for the last rescue. About halfway up, there were problems with the lifting cables. Rescuers dropped the diving bell back to the bottom and then pulled it up by hand with only one frayed strand of cable still intact. The final rescue took many hours using that frayed cable. Persico's father had died in 1929. The family, including Persico's mother, Carmela Pinto, were kept informed as the rescue unfolded by Amsterdam police, who stopped at the family home with updates. The family received two telegrams from the Navy. The first said Persico was alive. The second said he had been rescued. When his mother visited Persico at a hospital after the rescue, he told her he would continue in the submarine service, adding his shipmates felt the same. The Navy was able to raise the Squalus. It was repaired and recommissioned as the Sailfish and was awarded 9 battle stars in World War II. Persico did not serve any more on the Sailfish, but he served aboard two other submarines. One of them, the USS Batfish, sank 3 Japanese subs. He earned a Bronze Star. A stone marking his Navy service is at Fifth Ward Veterans Park. His nephew, Anthony Signoracci, said Persico always had a sly smile on his face. I think it was because he cheated certain death. Persico retired from the Navy in 1956 as a chief torpedo enlisted man and also a recruiter, and then he had a career as a heavy equipment salesman in the Capital Region for L.B. Smith Company. Amsterdam historian Hugh Donlan wrote the Recorder story in 1961 when Persico visited Portsmouth Naval Shipyard for the first time since 1939. It was there the Squalus had been built. He was there, Persico was, for the launch of the nuclear submarine Tenosa. On hand for a picture were Persico, Congressman Sam Stratton, and John Donlan, Hugh Donlan's son. John was executive officer of Tenosa, and later in his Navy career, commanded nuclear submarines. Persico married Felicia Puglia of Amsterdam in 1973. They met at the bar of the former Peter Stuyvesant Hotel in Amsterdam. They married years later when Persico returned to Amsterdam after his mother died. They had no children. "He was my hero," said Felicia. In the year 2000, Persico was one of the Squalus survivors at a ceremony naming a destroyer for the man who organized their rescue, Charles Swede Monson. Persico died in 2001. The intersection of Florida Avenue and Bridge Street was named Persico Square that year. And that particular story I often call Rescued from the Deep. Another tale from Focus on History, as we continue with this Focus on History podcast, headlined Growing Up in Fort Johnson. Constant reader and frequent contributor David Edward Noyes, 92, of Evergreen, Colorado, has passed away. Dave Noyes was born in 1931, the son of Harold and Edwina Gerling Noyes. He was the second of four boys and grew up in Fort Johnson. Dave said when he was a child, adults in Fort Johnson provided children lifetime values by deed and example and maintained an active community. He recalled commercial institutions in Fort Johnson, such as Whalen's Grocery Store, Quinn's Gas Station, Sweet's Furniture, and Tallner's Ice Cream. Dave was the second of four brothers. His brother Dan Noyes drowned in the Mohawk River in 1947. His brother Randy died in an accident while serving with the U.S. Air Force. Dave attended Fort Johnson Grammar and Junior High Schools. The Fort Johnson Athletic Association produced top speed skaters in the 1940s, including Hank Flesch, Don Talmadge, Gene Gage, George Hare, and Ted Ellenwood Jr. Dave took up speed skating and described himself as one of the run-of-the-mill skaters in Fort Johnson, winning a few medals along the way. He kept skating until knee and hip replacement surgeries in the year 2000. Dave learned to fly at the Carpet City Airport at Midline Road and Route 107 in Perth. The local airport flourished in the late 1940s. Dave was in the Air Scout program in 1947. The curriculum officially included only pre-flight activities, but Dave and his fellow scouts actually flew planes with local World War II veterans as instructors. The scouts wore powder blue uniforms and had World War II surplus gear at the Perth Carpet City Airport, including a miniature jet engine. "Firing it up was quite impressive," Dave said. "Pleasant memories, great learning experience." Dave worked on footballs for Colette Sporting Goods in Amsterdam as a high school student. That's making footballs. He was paid in cash, some of which went into his bank account. Dave said, with the amount entered with ink pen, still have those bank books. He graduated in 1949 from Wilbur Lynch Senior High in Amsterdam, went on to the SUNY College of Forestry and Environmental Science in Syracuse. He entered the U.S. Army in 1952, served with an armored division in Germany. After military service, he resumed his college studies and graduated with honors. He married Mary Ann Gavron of Amsterdam, who survives him, in 1956. Dave joined the Johns Manville Corporation as a research engineer. His career took him to the world headquarters of Johns Manville in Denver. He retired in 1994 as a manager of environmental affairs. The village of Fort Johnson is slated to formally dissolve on the last day of this year, becoming a hamlet in the town of Amsterdam. The town will become responsible for public works like snow plowing and so forth in Fort Johnson. Residents voted 90-23 to dissolve the village in a referendum late last year. Dave's daughter, Julie Matern, said, "Dad did know about this. Although he understood the logic of it, he was disappointed, sad, by the absorption of his little burg. Not a big fan of consolidation in general." His daughter continued, "I'm happy to report Dave Noy's childhood home is in the best shape that it's been in 40 years. Thanks for listening to our podcast composed of some of my columns, focus on history from Daily Gazette and Amsterdam Recorder. Let's end with a few words from Charlie Gehring. Charlie Gehring is a scholar studying early Dutch and translating records of the Dutch colony that existed here in what we call the state of New York, and he works down in Albany. But Charlie grew up in Nellaston in the Mohawk Valley and frequently sends comments to me on stories that I've written. And we wrote a story about the luxury of Fort Plain, manufacturer of primarily ladies' panties and other lingerie in Fort Plain. And it turned out that Charlie Gehring's mother worked for lingerie for 27 years. At the same time, his father worked at Beechnut. And one of his jobs was to turn the boilers on, which meant he had to go to work early. So he was always home when Charlie came home from a grade school in Nellaston. And Charlie wrote, "Around 4:30, we'd go over street." He always uses this expression in going from Nellaston to Fort Plain to pick up my mother. My father always parked right in front of Bruschetti's Eternal City Bar, which was across the street from the entrance to the luxury. He always had just enough time for one beer. Sometimes Charlie would be placed on the counter while that was going on, and they'd pick up his mom. The Eternal City Bar restaurant was operated by Romolo and Josephine Bruschetti, both natives of Italy who met in Fort Plain and got married and started this restaurant business, which continued for many years. Charlie Gehring was born in his grandmother's house in Fort Plain. His family moved to Nellaston sometime after World War II. My sister also had this experience of going to a bar with older relatives, and they would put her on the counter, and it was just part of growing up in the 30s and 40s. Well, thank you very much for listening to the Historians Podcast. I'm Bob Cudmore.